The crushing weight of patriarchal religion and society threatens women in the north of Norway as the witch hunts seek out anyone who is other. The Witches of Vardo, a historical fiction novel centered on the witch trials in Norway in the 1660s, is what this episode is all about. Well, actually, this episode with Anya Bergman, best-selling author of The Witches of Vardo, is about disrupting materialism, about writing, patriarchy, and spirituality. I'm super happy to share it with you. If you're a writer or a reader, you'll love this interview. And I want you to stay tuned all the way through to the very end to hear Anya read the story of the three mothers of folktale, one of the many folktales from her book. This conversation is wide-ranging. It's about writing. It's about spirituality. It's about the intersection of those two. It's about why feminist retellings and witch lit is so popular these days. In the show notes, you'll see links to all the events and opportunities to connect with Anya and her work. She's also written under the name Noelle Harrison, 13 novels and 5 plays. It was an absolute pleasure to talk with her. Thank you for sharing this episode, buying the book. I'm telling you, you're going to love the book. Oh my goodness. And for just sending me all your messages and emails and just connecting with me about this podcast. I really appreciate it. And thanks for tuning in. We'll see where I am next time I'm recording a podcast. Welcome to That Good May Become with me, Laura Scappaticci, where we learn to illuminate the esoteric in our everyday lives. Hey, Anya.
Hello. Hi, Laura.
Oh, thank you so much for saying yes to being on That Good May Become with me. I'm super excited. I have your book right next to me. I'm actually on page 189 right now, and I can barely pull myself away from it. It's really so beautiful, and that plot is moving so fast right now, and I'm just like, what's going to happen to these characters? Oh, my goodness. So, but there's so much more behind this book than, you know, a plot and characters. There's so much history and pain and, you know, I don't know. I think maybe usually what I start out with is a question to my guest about a spiritual experience they've had. And there's so many incredible layers of spiritual experiences in this book. So I don't know, where do you want to start? I want to let you run this. So
wow. Well, that's really, thank you so much, first of all, for reading the book. And I'm delighted to hear you're gripped. And yes, you're right. There's so much more to this book, The Witches of Vardo, than a pacey plot. And it is based on true events that occurred in the far north of Norway in 1662, when some women were accused of witchcraft. But because I knew you were going to ask me the spiritual experience question, so I've got kind of two answers, because there's spiritual experiences related to this book, but also spiritual experience, kind of the biggest spiritual experience of my life as well, which is a very big part of who I am now. So I kind of want to say a little about that as well, if that's okay.
Oh, yes, please do.
But in relation to the book, so I started out writing books that were kind of set in the past, but the recent past. And then as time has gone by, I've kind of set them further and further and further in the past. And this particular book, The Witches of Vardo, has been a 10-year project.
Wow. And this 10 years of writing. Years,
I started researching it 10 years ago when I lived in Norway. And for me, it has really been a devotion, I think, is the kind of best way to put it, a devotion to the real women who were accused of witchcraft, that I've been absolutely intent upon raising their lost voices and with tenderness. And so it was a huge challenge to write the book and be true to those real historical figures, but also write a book that readers were going to want to read, because it was no good if people were going to put it down because it was just too dark or too grim. So I had to kind of work a way of doing that. But one of the things that I felt, I mean, I traveled up to this tiny island of Vardø, which is so far north in Norway, you won't believe it, above the Arctic Circle, that you're like, who could live up here? But people do. And really intense climate, very harsh conditions. And when I went up there, I visited this memorial. I'm pronouncing it Stelneset Memorial, so I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, which was created to honor all the people executed for witchcraft. And I found this place intensely spiritual. All memorials should be spiritual, but this is a particularly powerful place. And it was after I visited this place of memorial to those accused of witchcraft that the way I related to the creation of this book changed and became much more spiritual, you could say. So the memorial is created by the Swiss architect Peter Zumthor, and it's also the last work by the American-French sculptor Louise, and I'm going to pronounce her surname wrong now. I think it's Beaujeu or Bourgeois. Have you heard of her?
Mm-mm, but wow.
She's really famous, and I apologize if I'm spelling her pronouncing her surname wrong. But she did the big spiders outside the Guggenheim in Bilbao.
Oh, yes.
So people know, they'll go, oh, yes, her. Mm-hmm. Anyway, she agreed to do this. It was her last work. And the memorial part of it, the part that Peter Zumthor created, is based on the fishing racks up in the far north. But it's giant, and it's situated right on the place where the women were executed. So during the 17th century, 100 people were executed, for witchcraft in this particular place, and they were burned at the stake. Whew. So it's really intense place, and it's right on the edge of the island, and the Varanga Sea is crashing, you know, on the coast, and then it's crossed from this kind of mountain called the Domen, which they used to call the entrance way to hell. Very powerful place. So you go inside these giant fishing fracks, and inside is this long, long corridor. And there's light bulbs kind of lowered at different heights. And on the wall, written on the wall, are the stories, the real stories of each single person executed. A homage to every single person is named. It's quite astonishing. And these stories were written by the academic professor Liv Ellen Willemsen, who is, if anyone is interested in this period of history, she's written a lot on it, and she gave me a lot of help when I was writing my novel. So you walk down this inside these fishing racks, and the wind is blowing and buffeting you, and I'm honest to God, it's so intense. And then you come out of this and you go over to Louise's installation, which is like this little dwelling, and inside is just a regular chair, but there's a flame burning from the chair, an eternal flame burning. And then there are these huge mirrors, like Alice in Wonderland mirrors, suspended all around it. So when you look in the mirrors, you see yourself in the flames.
Oh my goodness.
Incredibly intense as well. So after this, I was quite shaken by the experience of going to this memorial. And when I came back down to where I was living in the city of Bergen at the time, and I continued to work on the book, and I went in very deep, and I really kind of, in my dream, I would have kind of night terrors that I was in the witch's hole, and I started remembering paintings that I did as a teenager of a woman in a witch's hole. And I thought, my God, you know, without sounding a bit naff, I'm pretty certain I was there, you know?
Oh, yeah. It sounds like it.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I was there. And so I kind of started channeling that a little bit in my writing. And so I feel that whole journey with this book has been, there have been a lot of blocks to it. A lot of things got in the way. And I thought, this is interesting, because the kind of purpose of the book was, to put it in a few words, down with the patriarchy. So, yeah. You know, it's about tapping into feminine power, feminine wisdom. And yeah, there were a lot of blocks on the way, which was quite interesting. But it became like this just calling for me, I guess, that I had to write the book. Mm. So that's kind of my, and I do feel that about that with historical fiction, that for me to kind of get into a book, I need to connect with the characters and almost open myself up to listening to them. And once I can trust in that connection, then the story flows. And sometimes they take me in different directions from what I've mapped out and planned.
It's so incredible.
We're going that way.
Oh, I know the characters do. And we could talk about them in a minute, but like that's an incredible and intense story. And I mean, you're definitely on the right podcast because anyone that has a connection to anthroposophy generally has a sense of reincarnation. So
yeah,
you were in one of those witch holes is going to make perfect sense for people, especially like how it showed up for you early. But I what a profound experience to walk into. This is why art and literature are so important, because how moving it was to have that tribute that is a piece of art and a memorial at the same time and has that spiritual quality, and then led you to this deepening of your relationship with yourself and with the characters, and then to find those obstacles. You know you're on the right track when there's a little trouble, I think, you know?
Yeah, there were a good few really unforeseen blocks, mm-hmm. Which was really interesting. And there were moments when people said, you know, let it go. And I was just like, nope.
You had to write that.
Yes, can't. So, which was really, really interesting. And I probably bored a lot of people going on about trust. But it's quite interesting because when I first started working on the book, it was before kind of, you could say, this current kind of wave of interest in witch lit. And now it's just growing and growing. And maybe, you know, just thinking about talking about it here with you now, maybe a lot of people are connecting into past life experiences. As well, because thousands and thousands over 300 year period of history were, you know, accused and many of those executed for witchcraft. Mm-hmm. Most of whom were women, not all, but most of them were women, mm-hmm. Or outsiders in society, you know?
Yeah. And I'm so attached to the characters in here and like sort of can relate to all of them in different ways. But before we go there, did you have another experience you wanted to talk about? Yeah, tell me.
Because it kind of changed me forever. And it's going to sound a bit sad, but it's not sad. So my mother passed away in 2005. And she was quite a remarkable woman. She was a very spiritual woman. She actually was a Catholic, but she was an unmarried mother and she never followed the rules. So she kind of was a mystic Catholic that didn't believe in the rules. She always had to do things her own way. But I was with her when she passed. And I think that experience of being with someone that you love when they pass over is such a privilege and an honor. And I think as a child, because she was a single mom, my biggest fear, my biggest nightmare was something would happen to my mother. You know, my mom would die. And then suddenly at the age of 36, 37, my mom had terminal cancer. She was dying, you know, and it was like my worst nightmare had come true. But through that experience of being with her and loss, it became she kind of gave me a gift. Through that, because she passed with such dignity. And there was definitely, for me, it was incredibly spiritual. And it changed the way I wrote as a writer after this experience, because I do absolutely know 100% when I was in the room with her, I saw her soul depart her body. And there was a moment when she was in her body and then she was a shell. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean.
Yeah. So that changed everything for me. And obviously I was bereft. I'd lost my mom and I was grieving, but at the same time I began to see more color in the world. I began to feel more love in the world. And I began to kind of almost understand my creativity more, my connection to my creativity through that experience of so kind of connecting with her soul passing. I wrote lots of poetry at the time and I'm really crap at writing poetry, but that poetry is good. That's my biggest spiritual experience, I think.
That's really intense. I mean, I have a whole season on death and dying and connecting with the dead in this podcast. And it's one of the ways that I think people can connect most people can find a spiritual side to themselves through death. Yeah. And in your case, it deepened it. And, you know, I had a similar experience with my mother too. And I was 26 when she died. And I, same thing. I was like, if my mother ever dies, I'll die, you know? And, yeah. and in a way you do die. And then you're born into something else. And so, you know, you're born into this creative life and having witnessed that and like getting this strong sense of yourself and your direction from her. And I think it's interesting that you said you experienced more love then. Can you say a little more about that?
Yeah, I just felt like when she passed over, all the love that came from those around me became heightened. And I think that's, you know, I learned to understand what people are going through when they lose someone as well. And that I really appreciated every single kind of gesture of love from people that you just wouldn't expect it from, not just family and friends, but the small acts of consideration and love as well. It really blew me away. And I think that, yeah, I mean, one of the things, the last thing my mother said to me, literally her last words were, "I will love you always." And I realized that, you know, love is stronger than death. That's what I believe anyway.
So, absolutely.
Yeah.
And there's echoes of that in this book, I'm sure, that I'm not at the end yet. And goodness gracious, I'm going to have a gin and tonic after, or a very, very strong cup of tea and a lot of chocolate. But I know I can sense parts of what is coming. And that loss and that continued connection that just persists. And look at these women connected with you and persisted through you in this way. And so, you know, love is greater than loss. And there it is. So, yeah. Wow. Oh, my goodness. Okay. You know what I did? Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, yeah, don't worry. I mean, right at the end of the book, one of the things that's so important to me as a writer is I don't like to leave readers in a dark place. So,
Oh, good. Well, you know what we didn't talk about when we chatted right before we started recording is you reading a part or a portion or two of the book. And when I went to your reading for Lighthouse Books in Edinburgh, this book is filled with these incredible stories, like myths as well. And you read the one at the end of the book, and it was so powerful for me just to hear that. Again, a story of persistence. And it was just really beautiful with the links. So maybe at some point in this podcast, if you want to read something, whatever your favorite thing to read is from the book, that would be super. Okay, so how about we thank you for sharing those two really powerful spiritual experiences. And what is your writing practice like? And how does that include spirituality for you? Because I know I've had you in class, and like the minute you walked in, I was like, oh, she's got something going on. I could just feel it. I was like, okay, this is my person here. I could really feel it. And then you did this tarot, you know, session with us where you gave us, like, it was so amazing. Like, you walked in front of us and like gave us each a card. And I think it was for all of us, if we're tuned in, like exactly the right card we needed for that, mm-hmm. that moment in time. So, you know, you have that link with the spiritual world and the people in front of you and what moves between us. Right. So what is that like for you in writing?
Wow. Well, yeah, that's interesting because the tarot, I find a really powerful tools in terms of creative writing. They can connect to our subconscious, but they can also kind of push us to think or look at things from a different angle as well, as a prompt. But yeah, I believe there was something that I've always believed is the best writing is written from the heart. So while I do think it's great to have all the techniques and skills, you know, for a writer, you know, learning about narrative position and structuring and all of that is fantastic, I do believe that to actually kind of get going, the most powerful thing is to actually connect to your heart space and your subconscious. And if we are too much in our head, it can actually block us, because that's where those critical voices reside, isn't it, in our head? That's where the imposter syndrome sets up and goes, you can't do this. Mm-hmm. So the more that we connect to our heart and flow with that flow of creativity within our being, the more it can open up. So in terms of my own personal practice as a writer, a few things are kind of involved, I guess. I mentioned before that I kind of open up to the characters. So I do literally spend quite a lot of time trying to find the characters who want to tell the story. And sometimes it changes. It might be, I think the story is going to be from a certain character's point of view. And then it's like, no, someone else wants to tell that story. So I spend a bit of time trying to find the person who I'm going, you know, this character who's going to kind of speak to me. And at the same time, I try to open up my heart to the themes that I want to explore. And for me, very much with historical fiction, it's to do with connecting to feminist retellings, you know, telling those stories that we know so well from history, but from a different angle. And we might not even realize that we've just accepted a patriarchal kind of version of events without questioning it. But also writing is for me coming from the heart, but in the whole body. So that's where my breath work and my meditation and my yoga come in. And they kind of unlock me totally to my creativity. So I would probably start the day. I might actually wake up and immediately write if I kind of wake up and the voice is there, you know, the character. And I might write for a couple of hours, or else I'll do some meditation and breath and some movement. And I think a lot of the time people have this image of writers, you know, sitting stationary at the desk, you know, sitting still, writing away. But we can write with our whole body, actually. And the more that we connect to our body through that breath, through gentle movement, you know, sometimes I like to dance and I kind of catch that thread of the story. So I think it's quite interesting that it's just never really, well, not that explored that much. So yeah, I would, and my, it's kind of different every day, you know. I'd be lying if I said I sit down every morning at 8 and work away, you know, because I don't. And the, I guess the other aspect that's very important is nature. Mm-hmm. Nature is hugely important for my writing practice. And I usually, you know, if I'm writing all morning, I'll go for a walk at lunchtime and just absorb my surroundings. And always that walk will bring me something else, to so that when I come back, I've got more energy, more inspiration to write. The way I work would be, maybe I won't write for a few days. I'll just be thinking and absorbing. And then when I actually sit down and write, I might write for 5 hours without stopping.
Right.
So I'm kind of intense.
You know, it's so, a few things. Thank you. It's so refreshing to hear this perspective, this very feminine perspective of what writing looks like, that includes movement and nature and this sort of opening. And, you know, you said trying to find the characters who want to tell the story and being open to the themes and sort of letting them come through you. It's such a receptive feminine gesture towards the practice of writing. And I really appreciate that. And I think, you know, I can definitely, that there's a struggle in me. I think I want to write that way. And that's how I naturally write. And the reason I think I enjoyed writing when I was in undergrad is I was working with Natalie Goldberg's work.
I love her.
Oh my gosh. I'm in a class with her right now. So live.
Oh my God, you're serious?
I know. Yeah.
Well, she actually inspired me when I first started writing. I began with Natalie Goldberg.
Yes. Oh my gosh. And amazing. I can't believe I dropped out of school and I'm back with Natalie now. And I was on a call last night. There are like 500 something people on these live calls with her.
Wow.
And my youngest came in, Valentina, and she was sitting with me and she was like, Mom, we did an exercise just quickly. We had to write for 1 minute about sound without using the word sound, and then red without using the word red. And then bitter without using the word bitter, and rough without using the word rough. So all the senses, essentially. So then Valentina raised her hand, made me raise my hand in the Zoom room. And then they called on me and I had to read my writing out loud to Natalie Goldberg. I was like freaking out, and I could barely read my handwriting, but I was like, we only have 1 minute for each, like literally 60 seconds. And so it was very potent and powerful. So anyway, she's about that the meditative space and also embodying and all the senses, like having all the senses present. And your book is so full of that. Like the nature, the way that you describe the animals, and I just read the scene where the lynx is with Zara, right? And
yes.
Ingeborg, and yes. You know, comes up and kind of walks around them. And I felt like the lynx was like looking at me. Like I could feel the presence of the lynx, and the way you describe like the snow and, you know, it's padding around them, and, you know, the stare, and just so intense with the animals all through this book, and nature all through this book. I can experience the depth of connection you have with nature and with, you know, the natural world, and also with the spiritual world, and the way that you the characters explain their spiritual connections and experiences. It's really powerful writing. I love it. Do you have a scene, like a nature scene or something you would like to read? I know I have pages folded over here.
Why don't you pick a favorite one and I'll just grab the book because it's on the other side of my room.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm back.
Okay, that's great.
So okay, so this is about the lynx, and I have seen lynx in Norway. So
wow, you have.
So beautiful. Yeah, oh. This is so beautiful. So this is from Ingeborg's point of view, whose mother has, just to put a little bit of context here, her mother has been accused of witchcraft and brought to the fortress on the island of Arda to undergo trial. And she is on a mission to try and rescue her. And she's being helped by her friend Maren, who is quite a dangerous character, you could say. She's the daughter of an accused witch. And this Sami boy called Zara. So at this point, Zara and Ingeborg have come across the lynx. Such cruel beauty took Ingeborg's breath away. Cloud white fur, so soft she longed to put her hands upon it. But of course that would have meant instant death. Magnificent jaws and sharp teeth. But it was not snarling at them. The paws were huge, sheathing deadly claws, Ingeborg knew. Its white coat was spotted with dark brown smudges, and its magnificent head possessed pointed ears with long tips of fine fur. Her eyes were drawn to the great lynxes, full as they were with rich, warm colour, gold, amber, flashes of sea green, and flecks of deep brown. The lynx circled where they stood, slowly, almost languorously. Ingeborg caught the glint of Zara's knife in his hand, but what good would his small blade be against such an adept predator? They held their breath, and suddenly, as if they weren't worth its interest, the wild cat turned away from them. It crept across the snow in silent stealth and then broke into a run, back the way they had come to the west. "It's heading inland to find some wood," Zara said, sheathing his knife again. "I'm surprised to see it on the mountain, as it will find little prey." "Why did it not kill us?" Ingeborg said in a shaky voice. Zara turned to her. "It is very unlikely a lynx would attack us, more likely a wolf or bear, though they are asleep still," he said. But beneath his words she could see he was as shaken as she. "You were trembling with the cold." He pulled her to him and hugged her. His action was so intimate, so shocking, she didn't know what to say. "He's just warming me up so I don't die of the cold," she told herself. But she could not help but inhale his scent, long to remain in his embrace when he let her go. "We'd better catch up with Maren." Maren. Zara's mention of her name created an unsettling jolt within her. The eyes of the lynx, all those colours within them, the umber and gold shards of sea green. She shook herself. What a foolish notion. Maren would be sorry she missed seeing the lynx. They flashed across the frozen white summit of Doman, propelling themselves faster, speeding down the other side of the mountain. The snow sprayed up around Ingeborg and stung her face. A sudden squall obscured them within a fog of driving snow, yet on they went. When the blizzard eased, they were at the bottom of the Devil's Mountain. The clouds dispersed reveal the Varanger Straits. By the sea's edge, a small settlement of coastal Sami was living in a cluster of turf-clad goati. On the other side of the frothing water rose the rocky island of Varda. No destination.
So, oh my gosh. I mean, I could see it. I could feel it. I could practically taste it. The cold, the warmth, the fear, all of it. The wondering, the thinking, you know, this connection with Marin and the Lynx and just all of it. And the danger that was averted somehow and the danger to come. Right there, just in a page and a half. I mean, the whole book is like that.
Yeah, it's very, I mean, I think it's very intense setting, I suppose. So it heightens all the emotions of the characters. But I mean, I do, having lived for 6 years in Norway, and before that I visited as well, there's kind of this feeling you get up in the far north, this, because the nature is so extreme, and I met people who went to live there who weren't from the north. They kind of had north fever, if you know what I mean. Mm. This kind of obsession with the nature up there. And I think I have it a little bit, you know. And I'm not into skiing or anything, but I'm really into these far north kind of countries and territories where you've got this thick snow that's like powder. And then the skies are just insane, like pastel, all these pastel shades, and then of course you've got the aurora borealis as well. Just everything seems kind of magical.
yeah it's that presence all around, and the extreme, I think, too, you know, makes it feel, it gives a sense of power, like you're saying. So the night and the daylight and the nighttime and the cold and the clear sky and woo, and then like the call of the birds, like all of these things, it's just an intense setting for sure.
I was just going to mention the Sami as well. Like, if you look at their mythologies and beliefs, it's such a beautiful spiritualism or faith. I'm not quite sure how to describe the religion, but yeah, it's the, in essence, it's very connected to that nature.
Mm-hmm, because we have the shaman and, you know, his wife that was accused as well, and then we have the son of the shaman as well, and that. The protected magic, in a way, and you know, and the persecution that they suffered as well. I mean, we see that in all indigenous cultures. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So, how about all of them are endearing to me. Anna is, she is something else. I like the stage of life she's into because I can relate to what she's going through there, being 47. And then you've got the sweetness of these sisters and then the wildness of Marin. How did these characters come through you? And, you know, who was, I don't know. I find with my characters and what I'm writing, I have one that whispers a little more strongly to me than the others. That's like, I'm front and center, like put me right here. But the balance is so strong here. Who was there, anybody that was like really pushing at you? Like, hey, write me.
Yeah, they kind of took their turns. Because I was working on it for so long, they each took a turn. when I first started working on it, it was definitely Marin. And I thought she was going to be one of the narrators. But she actually isn't. And I think that's because of who she is. She's needs to be a little bit more enigmatic. But she came to me, all these women came to me from original documentation, from the actual original trial records. I could read what they said in court in 1662. And I drew their characters from their testimony. So Marin in particular is, she's just such a storyteller, and her testimony is so wacky and weird. And she's just like, yeah, me and the devil, we went in, you know, into the valley of hell, and he cooked me a ham in the boiling, water where all the people were dying, you know, like it's insane. She's so like unapologetic. And I just thought, wow. So I thought, okay. That's where she came from. And then Ingeborg, also we have I don't want to create any spoilers, but the point in the book when you hear her testimony is true.
Wow.
What she really said, and I interpreted that testimony to something that happens to her in the novel. Again, I don't want to give any spoilers. So she came across as way more stoic because she gave her testimony and then she refused to speak after that. She I thought, no, this is a more kind of slightly more cautious character. She came to me for the longest, I guess. Maren came first and then Ingeborg came for a very long time. Mm. And I wrote one version of the book with her speaking in first person. And then the last two kind of knock on my door was Anna. Mm-hmm. And originally in early versions of the book, Anna was more of a background character. But as I investigated her real story, she was a real Danish woman and she really was exiled to Varde for life, and she was blamed for the witch hunts. And I thought, now hang on, this is interesting. And then I started looking into her background story and, you know, this testimony of things that she said, and she just started coming across as this kind of very highly intelligent but frustrated middle-aged woman who wasn't being allowed to show her like power, you know.
And then also
when I started working on her, I was going through menopause, so it kind of timed well.
Totally.
And she therefore became the first person narrator, and I have to say I really connected to her really strongly, even though she's not a particularly likable person.
Yeah, right.
She's very complicated. And even when I read sections of the book that's in her voice, it creeps me out a bit how it's almost like I don't need to read the book. I can feel her in me, you know? Mm.
Yeah, so, she's very strong and she is so complicated. And I think it's nice to have a really complicated character in there because, you know, life is not so clear and she's making decisions for her own life and based on her experiences under patriarchy, right? And her conception of love and how she can be seen, you know, and to be going through all of that and also be a woman and be someone that has healed and helped other women, it's such a complicated thing. And I think we all know complicated people like that, but she is very strong for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I think she goes on a big journey on the book, you know, how she starts at the beginning of the book and then, you know, the place where she ends up. She's the character that kind of has to change the most or go through transformation.
Yeah, the journey of transformation. Yes. Mm. Yeah, I know. I'm not at the end, so I don't know what happens with her. So,
I can't tell you.
Any of them. Don't tell me. So, any other sort of experiences with this book that kind of stand out to you as you were moving through it, and now that it's out in the world, you know, how it feels, all of those things.
Gosh. I was working on it a lot in Norway. I guess it's interesting because I worked on it over a 10-year period of time, but each version that I wrote quite fast. So I was researching it a lot in Norway and having those night terrors. And there was one day, and you're going to think I'm totally cuckoo now, but I was so like lost in the book. I just turned on my cooker and put my hand on the hob to see what it felt like to be burned, you know, which was a really weird thing to do. You recommend it to anyone researching book, and that hurt.
I know. Yeah.
That hurt a lot. And it kind of blew my mind because I was like trying to understand what they went through.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Was just really unbelievable. But then when I was continuing to work on it, when I lived in Scotland, the version that has made it into print was written during lockdown. And I was on my own during lockdown as well for 12 weeks.
Mm.
And that was very intense and challenging. And I knew when I was like, okay, I have to go back into the book, I knew it was going to, I was going to be going into a dark place mm-hmm. for a while. I had to kind of go, okay, take a deep breath, because, you know, it wasn't easy, you know, and yeah. also just being totally alone. So not quite sure how spiritual that was. I guess I did a lot of spiritual practices during that time in lockdown to help me.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of connecting to my meditation practice and practicing with other people online as well. And I was sharing practices, which really helped me.
Mm.
So I was sharing meditation and journaling and creative unlocking practices, and also sharing how to use tarot. And that really helped me as well, because my only interaction was online.
Right, right. Oh gosh, we so need community, don't we? And it's so, yeah. you know, you have that sense of these communities in this book, and when it gets disrupted by a power of displacement or patriarchy, like coming in and destroying, you know, because there's this scene in there with the dancing, and it's so beautiful and joyful, and then this force comes in and disrupts and condemns, and it's like, ooh, you know, I feel like, and then there's isolation and fear going on. So yeah, we all need ways to connect in spiritually and in community. And what happens when fear is placed upon communities, as we saw in the pandemic in a different way, is so much fear.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, it, you know, I remember, because I was in the city of Edinburgh, so there were people all around, but it was just a horrible atmosphere of kind of panic and fear. And I remember one day walking on my own, and, you know, you don't quite realize, I mean, I'm lots of people had really terrible times in the pandemic, and mine wasn't as bad as many, many people. But I think, unless you actually were completely alone for those 12 weeks, I don't think people quite know how it was, because right. I'm a very huggy person. So I remember going for this walk, and there was a dog, and I just wanted to touch a living thing, you know?
Yeah.
So I leant down to stroke this dog, and this woman went wild at me not to touch her dog, because she said she was going to catch COVID from me if I touched her dog. I mean, that's how crazy things got. Mm-hmm. You know?
Oh yeah,
telling that story now, it just seems ludicrous. But
right,
but people were that afraid, and so I ended up having to hug trees.
Oh,
I to hug some trees. And I remember getting lots of plants and getting really excited. And I'm not good with plants, but. But I was like, if one more person puts up a post with a picture of their garden on Instagram, I'm going to go nuts.
right, if you don't have a garden flat, no, you can't get out, right?
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
My goodness, yes. Oh, yeah, that really sums it up. You know, you're also a very good storyteller just verbally here. So, I mean, all your spoken stories are full of amazing details as well as your writing. So, yeah. So that pandemic time, mm-hmm.
a tough, but kind of, you know, a good training as well of mm-hmm. self-sufficiency mm-hmm. and resourcefulness for me. But I can understand how for, you know, a lot of people that it, you know, it's triggered a lot of anxiety issues for many people, especially young people. So it's just really sad.
I was saying, you know, and maybe you've already answered this, that my friend Claire worked, you know, she has a memoir, and her family, they're Holocaust survivors. So that, you know, kind of lives in her body, and she's had to work through that. And, you know, you said you knew you were going to go into these dark places. And I think many, many writers, like, you have to have that capacity to kind of get in there and really work with it. Even if you're writing like Uplit or whatever, something really great, there's still darkness in life. So how do you work through that and care for yourself? And maybe you've said this in some of your practices, but I wonder specifically if you have any tips for people.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm not quite sure. I think I get through the darkness because I know it's necessary to get to the lightness, if you know what I mean. That for the story to authentically connect with the reader, they need to have gone on a journey, and maybe, you know, with historical fiction writing about these different difficult periods of history, we kind of need to open our eyes and go, okay, this darkness happened. You know, we can't ignore this. Which is why it infuriates me when people say, oh, you know, that happened hundreds of years ago, you know, right now. And I'm like, it's totally relevant now. Yeah. Like in so many ways.
Exactly.
You know, so I guess for self-care, I probably would work on the book and then I'd watch something really silly on telly.
I love that. Ted Lasso. That's like my new... Yes. Have you watched any Ted Lasso?
No, I haven't watched Ted Lasso.
Oh my God, please watch. I just watched the first episode. That's all I've watched. And I was like, I will never get enough of this character. Like, okay. He's just so positive. People have recommended
it to me.
Oh yeah. Actually. Here we go. I'm telling you, when you go to the dark place, just put on Ted Lasso after that.
So I can't watch heavy, dark things when I'm writing something dark. Yeah.
This is super fun. The funnest. Mm.
yeah okay, so I'll check that out later then. Yeah, something really, like I was watching Emily in Paris, really silly, right, and frothy, like, you know.
Yeah, exactly. That's perfect. Now, so why do you think what's witcherature, I mean, it didn't have a name like until how many years ago, right? So here we are, we're in the midst of this really strong movement with witch lit. Can you say a little bit more about that, and then, you know, and then I'd like to hear if there's anything else you want to say, and maybe you can read something again to close us out.
So Witcher or Witchlet.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people have been talking about it, and I think it relates to what I was just saying about how these stories are kind of very relevant now. They're kind of tapping into concerns of many people at the moment, concerns about women's rights being curtailed. And movements such as in Iran, you know, women are at the center of this movement for human rights. And if you look back to kind of when the witchlit began to kind of begin to grow, I guess you could say, it's connecting to the Me Too movement as well, and a reclamation of agency. So of course there's always been books and stories about witches, we all know that, but it's tended to be a little bit more in the realm of fantasy, and of course there's metaphors for the witches in fantasy connecting to empowerment. But witchlit is now kind of spreading to other genre, so historical fiction as well, and writing about witch trials, as well as non-fiction books becoming bestsellers, like Mona Chollet's In Defense of Witches, for instance, and then also moving into areas of wellness and spirituality. And I think a lot of people, a lot more people are identifying as witches as well, which is connected to the witchlit as an alternative way of expressing their spirituality. And I mean, I don't practice it myself, so I'm not an expert on it, but I would say it's about people who practice, you know, Wicca now. It's connecting to honoring nature, and I think because this whole issue of climate crisis is so urgent that people are looking for alternative ways to connect to spiritualism, and Wicca provides a way of honoring nature, of drawing healing from nature, and of agency as well, which I think is really interesting. And there's a huge movement of people who now identify as witches, so and not associated with the dark arts at all.
Right.
So I think that's very interesting. I've lost my trail now.
Come no.
Ask me.
No, that's great. I was just talking about the rise of that in, you know, in the novels we see.
Yes.
Yeah, witchlit.
Mm-hmm. So I think it's kind of it's political, but it's social, societal, I mean, political and societal as well. And I think also people who read witchlits, it's not just about the books and the authors and what we're writing, it's about the people engaging, the community of people reading witch books. Mm-hmm. Because with The Witches of Ardor coming out, I've had a lot of amazing readers and saying, I read Witchlit. That's the genre I read. And there's a community there that the readers have created.
That's really wonderful. And I mean, it is a sense, it gives people a sense of agency, I think, too. And like you said, connection. I just want to tell you this sort of funny, it's not funny, but this thing that I've been doing. I just gave a talk the other day in this anthroposophical group. And, I opened with the, a little more complicated over here, but the indigenous people of Scotland, the Picts and the Caledonians and the Scots. And then I talked about the indigenous plants and animals on the land too, because I felt like we need to honor those that have been destroyed as well. And that is so connected to any of the destruction that we unleash through patriarchy and colonialism, and it affects, you get this layer of the people, and then you get this layer of the animals and the land that have also been destroyed. So I'm trying to include that as well. And I think that's kind of witchy.
Yeah, it's very witchy, and it's very important. And you just kind of reminded me about why I love living in this part of the world, why I've chosen to live in southwest of Ireland, because I feel it is a place that connects to the divine feminine through nature. You know, there's tons of these ancient stone circles here. We don't really know why or what they were for. And even the way the landscape is shaped, there's two mountains here called Anu's Pops, Anu's Pops, which tells me the goddess Anu's breasts, basically. I just think that's hilarious. But another place I love to go to, I don't know if you've ever been there, is the Isle of Arran, west of Scotland. Which I think is just a portal to the divine feminine. Every time I go there are these standing stones there. Oh my God, I've forgotten the name of the name. The Macri standing stones. And every time I go there, it's like I feel I'm accessing something incredibly powerful in the landscape. This whole series of standing stones on this big moor, and beneath the there's an outline of a mountain named after, the crone, the kayak goddess. And it's just like, this is the divine feminine in essence, this part of the island. And people feel it. It's not, everyone feels it who goes there. And it's a place of great sustenance and nurture. We need to honor these places. So that's witchy too. Definitely.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, it's funny because I've got you in Ireland and my brother in Ireland, and the same thing. Like, he was like, I'm going to go move and be with the fairies. And I'm like, yes, you are. You're going to go do that. Like, it's Ireland just special. That elemental, the elemental beings, and it's just so strong and still intact. And, that is
and I think
really
that's
incredible.
To do with the people of Ireland as well, because certainly down the country, people of Ireland have always believed in fairies, the good people or whatever. They, your regular farmer will not cut down a fairy tree in Ireland. He might be the most practical man in the world.
Right.
He will not cut down that fairy tree.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a good thing to do. So, it's quite unique. And I think it's interesting as well to note that there's been very few witch trials in Ireland throughout history.
That is interesting. I know there were a lot in Scotland, right?
Oh, terrible.
Tons and tons.
Oh God, Scotland was fierce. And that was because of the reforming religion, the Calvinism, and the church, the church groups, the church committees were extremely active, proactive in hunting witches.
Oh, it's terrible. Terrible. Well, thank you for bringing these characters to us, these actual people to us, and giving them voices through the Witches of Ardo and through your writing. I want everybody to know about your retreats and writing retreats and things like that too. Can you talk about that? Because now they have a sense of your practices and how
Absolutely.
You nurture that. Yeah. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. So I also, I don't host them very often. But I do host now and again writing retreats, and the particular place where I run them is this amazing castle in Ireland, Springfield Castle in the southwest of Ireland. It is stunning. It's on like 200 acres of woodland, And it's got a medieval tower, and it's just beautiful. And there's so many spaces within it, little corners and nooks to write in, as you know, roaring fires and the lot. So I did one last year, which was just fabulous, and I'm going to be doing another retreat in October this year. But this one is slightly different. I'm collaborating with an amazing yoga teacher and friend called Bex Hunt. And we're running a yoga and creativity retreat. So this is about what I was talking about earlier, kind of getting into our senses through our body, opening up our heart space through gentle movement like breath and yoga, and then unlocking your creativity that way. So it's not just for writers, actually. I will be hosting a writing workshop on it, but Bex is also an amazing dance teacher. And she will be also hosting a dance workshop. And there'll be lots of chances to do lots of lovely things. And it's nearly sold out. There's only one twin room left.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
Yes.
Congratulations.
So if anyone wants to come, the link or something?
I'll include the link in the show notes for sure, so people can check that out. And what can we look forward to? What's your next book? Do you have a sense?
Oh yes, that? I'll tell you that. Actually, and also just so everybody knows, they might go, "Who's Noelle Harrison?" That's my other name.
Yes, great.
There we go. Who's that Noelle Harrison? That's Anya Bergman. My next book, and you're going to love the theme of the next book. Mm. It's called, the working title is "The Tarot Reader of Versailles." And it's set during the French Revolution, but it's also set in Ireland at the same time as well, because there was a lot going on in Ireland leading up to the Great Rebellion in 1798, and a lot of Irish were actually involved in the French Revolution as well. So I thought that was very interesting. But what I want to do with this period of history is take a look at this time of massive change, a lot of violence and death, but through a feminine lens, through the female gaze, through looking at it from the point of view of female characters that would have been involved and real historical figures. And there were a lot of amazing women who were pulled into this very powerful and dramatic period of history. So the Tarot Reader of Versailles is actually inspired by a real woman called Mademoiselle Lenormand, and she was a tarot reader and a psychic in France at the time of the revolution. And she was very, very young. She was only like 21, 22, and she had this incredible ability to read cards, and she became extremely popular and powerful. But it was also very dangerous because it was against the law. So that's all I'm going to tell you for the moment.
Oh my goodness. I cannot wait to read that. Yes.
And actually, I'm using tarot as well to help me write it.
Oh, cool. Oh my gosh. Of course you are. That's so awesome.
So whenever I get stuck, just pull a tarot card.
what a good idea. I'm going to have to, yes. I left my deck in Pennsylvania and I was like, why did I leave my deck?
Oh no.
I know my husband has a deck, so I can use his deck, but I need mine.
You should get another one. Get one while you're in Scotland. There is an amazing shop in Edinburgh, which I'm going to give a shout out for, because I just think it's an awesome witchy shop called Black Moon Botanica. Have you been there?
Yes, I have been there. It's on a Candle Row or something.
Yeah, Candlemaker's Row, and she sells incredible tarot decks there, as well as many other amazing things, particularly her candles and essential oils that she creates herself.
That is a really cool. I got my husband a deck there for Christmas. I got him the wrong deck though, so we're gonna have to go back. And I got a little bag to that's a great shop. I love places like that. They're so important just to have these gorgeous little. It is. Okay, so any tips that you would give someone that's trying to write something a little, you know, witchy or spiritual, or just anybody that's trying to write, I guess, because it's hard.
It is hard. It's really hard.
So
and it's
hard.
Really hard when, you know, you don't have a deadline.
Yes.
Life can get in the way. Mm-hmm. So I would say take yourself seriously, and make sure the people around you take you seriously. Mm-hmm. You know, this is an important part of who you are. You have this need, this urge to create and to write, and your story is of value. Your whatever you're going to write is of value. You are of value. So kind of claim a little bit of space and time to yourself. So in terms of space, literally kind of try and have a room, if ideally a room, if not a corner of a room. I mean, I wrote in a corner of a room for years and years and years. I've only just got a little room of my own. So I wrote the witch book in the corner of a bedroom. So you can do it. Yes. Or find a space you can go to write. And then also give yourself that time, no matter what comes up, say, this is my writing time. And in that sense, I think community can really help. If you have like a regular, let's say a little writer's group you can meet, or I do a weekly practice online as well called Write from the Heart, which is everyone kind of arrives on a Saturday morning online, and I guide people through a meditation, and then we all just write together for an hour. Gives you great accountability, and then we check in at the end, and it's great. Something like that. And just trust that you can do it as well. That you, I guess one of the things I would say is that don't let the imposter syndrome put you off. So I think one of the most useful things to know is that everyone gets imposter syndrome. Everyone, no matter how successful they are as a writer, unless they're completely deluded, everyone gets imposter syndrome. It's part of being a writer. And I think for me, what really helped was once I kind of accepted that there will always be this negative voice trying to pull me down, and that I should write despite the negative voices. That we're all going to have those moments when, what do you think you're doing? Who do you think you are? And also the other thing I would say, particularly if you're working, writing a witch book or a spiritual work, is look for signs, for affirmation.
That's really nice.
You know, the universe will offer them to you. You know, if you're having a hard time, if you're struggling, ask for signs. And maybe something might come up. You might see a particular animal, let's say a fox, and they might represent something for you. And then I would say, you know, go buy a little fox talisman. You know, have your crystals on your desk, have a little ritual before you start to write. All these things will help, help the mind relax.
So supportive, all of that. Yeah, wow. Ooh, I'll probably need the link to your Write from the Heart group too, so I can join it, but I guess I'll share it with other people.
Yes, you'll be so welcome. Everyone's welcome.
Great.
We love everyone's come. So.
That's fantastic. Oh, Anya, it's been so amazing to talk with you. Thank you again. And thank you for writing this gorgeous book and for just being a gorgeous human being and bringing yourself to all of us and sharing your spiritual experiences and your wisdom and your heart, so much heart there. And I think that that's what just makes you so magic, all of it. Thank you.
Well, same back at you, Laura, because it's been just so wonderful connecting with you and getting to know you. And I know 100%, you know, you're a writer with heart too. And this podcast is just wonderful as well. Just opening up so many different areas of thought and creativity for your listeners. So thank you for asking me.
Thank you so much. And hopefully I'll talk to you again when the next book comes out, if not much sooner.
Yeah.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thanks, Laura. Bye. The Three Mothers. In a time beyond our imagining, there were three mothers who lived at the bottom of Yggdrasil, the great tree of life, in the kingdom of Ysir by the sacred spring of fate. It was their task to nurture the great tree with the pure waters of the sacred spring, to preserve its life with the white clay from the spring and collect drops from the spring to sprinkle upon the grass as dew. The three mothers' names were Urt, Vertandi, and Skull, and it was they who wove the destinies of all. For the three mothers, all were treated the same because none, not even Odin, the father of all gods and men, had domain over them. All were subject to their fate. The mothers, or the Norns as they were otherwise known, were maybe sisters, maybe not, but one could not exist without the other. It was the work of the mothers to attend the birth of every newborn baby and weave the story of their lives. It was not a duty they took lightly. As each soul was born, the mothers poured care and consideration into creating the pattern of each life. Urte was known as the past or fate. She possessed long, free-flowing hair that changed colour with the seasons between shades of gold and brown. In the winter, it was the dark brown of bog water, but in the summer, it became the colour of a field of barley. Her skin also changed with the season, as did her eyes, honey and hazel in the summer, cream and burnt embers in the winter. Urte was full of laughter and light, offering as many different stories of a person's existence as she sang existence into the pattern of people's fate. Each note she uttered turned to a thread, each colour illuminating a pathway for the soul. Vathandi was known as the present or being. She had curling hair which was 1,000 shades of red. Vathandi was the smallest of the three mothers, as neat and tiny as one of the elf dwarves, but she possessed the most power. It was she who wove the secret to joy in a soul's life, but her essence was the hardest thread to find. She did not sing or speak, but breathed life softly in and out of people's hearts. She was as the sound of the sea upon the shore on a calm summer's day, or the soft sway of the wind in the branches. Skul was known as the future, or necessity. Her hair was the blackest black ever seen, with a lightning bolt of pure white shot through it. Skul was the most troublesome of the mothers. Sometimes she did not want to be a mother at all and would rebel against her sisters. What's the point of all our hard work weaving the fates of each newborn soul when our own futures are forever uncertain, she would complain, waving her unwritten scroll in her hand. But at other times, when the other two mothers had soothed her with fruits and wine, Skul would pick up her scroll and write and write and write. She never spoke the stories of the newborn soul's fate, but accounted for their life in ink upon parchment. None of us can pass by the three mothers when we come into life, whether we are gods, goddesses, humans, elves, dwarves, trolls, or frost giants. To the three mothers, we are all the same. Some of us will have golden fates, and some of us will struggle to leave the shadows, but we are all mothered, whether we like it or not, whether by blood or heart. The three mothers considered it their most important duty to protect women in childbirth. They drew healing from the great tree of life and plucked fruits from its boughs, which they would burn on a fire at its roots. These burnt fruits they would administer to women in their labours so that what was within may pass out. The three mothers wove into every single newborn soul, heaven and earth, with purple threads of faith from earth, green threads of love from Vathandi, and orange threads of hope from Skul. These were their gifts to all, who opened their hearts to receiving the wisdom of the mothers, that we possess destiny, but we can pull upon the threads we wish. The greatest gift of all was the gemstone Vathandi buried within the hidden third eye of all who breathe upon this earth. Even one-eyed Odin possesses it. It is there in the space between our eyes, on our brow. Close your eyes and seek it out. Can you see it shining? It is a gemstone, the purest and richest of all, set into the cloth of your life by the three mothers. It is your truth.